Well, good morning, everyone. It's good to see so many people in what's probably going to be the second most boring lecture of the morning. The first most boring lecture in the morning will be the next one that I do. So thank you very much for signing up for a legal history course, a legal history class. My goal this morning in part one will be to walk you through how we got the basic government institutions that we have and why they're so important, particularly why they're so important as a buttress against tyranny. That's going to be part one. If you're interested enough to stay for part two, that'll be the next workshop. I'm going to hone in on Canada's constitutional setup, why it's been set up well, but why it's also failing. And we're going to end with some ideas about how we fix the problem in Canada. So the first part, this one's actually going to be focused mainly in England, in the UK, because their legal history is our legal history. So on January 30th, 1649, King Charles I was beheaded by an executioner. He was the only monarch in English history to be executed. Why? Why was King Charles executed? Why did King Charles lose his head? Would you believe me if I told you it was because he abused his emergency powers? Now, Canadians are generally ignorant of how our government came to be, of the strife, the war, the torture, the loss, the sacrifice that was suffered and endured by so many to give us the relatively stable, accountable, democratic government that respects and upholds human rights and respects and upholds the rule of law. To have such a government does not just happen. It doesn't just happen. Indeed, for the vast majority of human history across the globe, the civil government has generally been unstable, tyrannical, unaccountable, and gross violators of human rights and the rule of law. So it doesn't just happen. We shouldn't just think that it evolves over time that we get a good, stable government. It happens because it comes out of a particular culture, a particular worldview. I want to start with this quote from Lord Acton, who has the second greatest beard in history, the first being Tim Stevens. Power tends to corrupt, he said, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And he's right. Lord Acton is right. He understands what it means to be human. Yes, made in the image of God, but fallen and tending towards evil. Our hearts are drawn towards evil in our fallen state. And so if we give unlimited power to a human being, to a single human being, that will corrupt them. And just be honest with yourself, right? If you had unlimited power, if nobody could ever challenge you at all in any decision that you make, you had total power, how would you use it? How would you use it? If we're honest with ourselves, we would abuse it. So we're going to go back in history. We're going to see this long struggle to contain absolute power and to understand how Canada got the government that it has. We're going to try to learn a few lessons about why we have the checks and balances that we have, and why those can't be ignored, why those can't be forgotten, and what we risk if we do forget those things. So a quick civics lesson here. Who here knows what the three branches of government are? Anyone want to throw out? Yes.
Federal, provincial, and municipal.
Okay, so those are three levels of government, federal, provincial, and municipal. But how do we branch them out? What do we have with the separation of power? Yes.
The legislature?
Yes. Okay, so the legislative branch would include House of Commons and Senate. The administrative side we just call some refer to it as the bureaucracy. It's the executive branch of government. What's the third branch of government? Remember? Yeah, the judicial. There we go. Executive, legislative, and judicial. Those are the three branches of government. And a long time ago, all three of those branches were vested in one single person. All three branches of those government, one person, that being the king. Okay, so that king then had total power, right? Because if we had actually three branches here, right, the executive is the branch of the government that carries out the government from day to day. They're the ones who execute the laws. They carry out the laws. The judiciary is the ones who interpret the laws and apply the rule of law to the government. And then the legislature is the one who carefully deliberate over laws and pass those laws. And they're separate from the executive. Okay, but if you put all of that into a single human being, you have absolute power. And as we said, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Okay, so we're going to go back in time. We got to start somewhere. I'm going to start with King Alfred the Great. I wasn't going to, except that there's the Alfred Academy here, and I thought I better do that. So I was going to start with Magna Carta, but we'll go back a little bit further than Magna Carta to the mid 1800s. 800, sorry, the mid 800s. So 849, this man was born, King Alfred the Great, and at that time in England, there's all kinds of little kingdoms. England was split up among different little kingdoms, and they're always being attacked by the Danes and the Vikings and so on. And the only way to push back against those invaders and those brigands was to unite the various little kingdoms in the UK and become one country of England. And King Alfred was the one who did that. Please note that he also has an impressive beard, almost as good as Pastor Tim Stevens. There's three things to know about King Alfred the Great. The first is that he unites that kingdom, the Kingdom of England, and he becomes their king. He's known to be a very good king, a very good ruler. And one of the things that he does, the second thing that he does, is that he writes a law code. Okay, the law code of Alfred the Great is a very, very famous law code. And what a lot of people miss, what Christians shouldn't miss, is that where King Alfred got his law code is from the book of Exodus. Right? He opens up the book of Exodus and he looks in there and he sees all kinds of great ideas, good prescriptions for how to write laws for the good governance of a country, particularly the Ten Commandments, but also a lot of the other civil laws in there. And that law code of King Alfred the Great is the basis for the development of English law from late 800s all the way to today. It's certainly changed a lot. But the basis, the foundation is there. The foundation is in the Word of God. Okay, so when we talk about how good our governments have been in the West, particularly within the English tradition, it's because a long time ago there was a good king who looked to Scripture and used that as his foundation for his law code. And he insisted then on making sure that that law code was followed. But how do you follow law if nobody knows how to read? How do you follow law if nobody knows how to read? Well, that was a big problem in England in the 1800s. Not a lot of people knew how to read. Very, very few people knew how to read. And so he pushed for a huge expansion in literacy within the kingdom. And so he tried to have all of the boys in the kingdom be able to read. It didn't matter what rank they were, what station, or what class they were. He wanted them to be able to read. And this is a bit of a side note, but this is one of the issues with the modern embrace in Canada of Indigenous legal systems. Because an Indigenous legal system in Canada is based not on a written law code, but on an oral tradition. But how do you measure the accuracy or the reliability or the objectivity of an oral tradition? It's whatever one elder says that he remembers of what was told to him by his ancestors. How do you double check that? How do you verify that? How do you go back to that? Well, the same thing with the law code with Alfred the Great. He said, we want to have a verifiable law that people can point to and say, this is the law. That's how you get rule of law. It's not an oral tradition. It's a written tradition, just like Scripture. God reveals himself through a written word. So that's a really, really important development, late 1800s. Okay, we've got to fast forward a little bit. We're going to go to the time of Robin Hood. And Robin Hood was a real guy, by the way. A lot of people are surprised to know that. But there are characters who lived in Sherwood Forest and other places in England in the 1200s, late 1100s, who were outlaws. And they would gather together as bands of outlaws. And Robin Hood was one of them. He wasn't called Robin Hood necessarily per se, but there were a few other guys were running bands of outlaws, and the legend of Robin Hood is built on true stories. So around this time of Robin Hood, this is around the time of time immemorial. Okay, have you ever heard of that going back into time immemorial? That's actually a legal term. Okay, so time immemorial ends on July 5th, 1189, because on July 6, 1189, King Richard the Lionheart ascends to the throne. He's crowned the king. Okay, so in English law, they would go back, trace the legal tradition of English law. They go back until the time of Richard the Lionheart, July 6, 1189. Any time beyond that is known as time immemorial. We don't have super clear written legal records before that time. And so anything beyond that is considered tradition. But then once Richard the Lionheart is on the throne, then we're dealing with recorded legal history. Okay, so time out of memory before Richard the Lionheart, and then we get legal history. Okay, so you all know Richard the Lionheart, right? Great king, big, bold, courageous king. Not a great king, actually. If you look at history books, King Richard the Lionheart, he reigned for 10 years, and of those 10 years, he was only in England for 6 months. The other 9.5 years, he was out making war in France and in the Promised Land, the Holy Land, and doing all kinds of crusades and fighting and so on. And he basically used England as his tax base to fund all of his military exploits. The only thing that made King Richard the Lionheart look good was that his brother was even worse than he was by a long shot. And his brother was the evil King John, right? From the Robin Hood tales. And King John was a tyrant. He was so bad that one time King Richard the Lionheart was coming back from the Crusades. He was crossing through Europe and he got kidnapped in Germany, somewhere in the German regions. And so the kidnappers sent a note to King John and said, "You got to ransom your brother. This is how much money we want." And he sent a note back saying, "Well, I'll pay you even more if you keep him." Because King John wanted to keep on reigning in his place. He was reigning as a vice regent under King Richard. Anyway, eventually King Richard dies, and he didn't have any kids, any sons, and so his brother John takes the throne, evil King John. And King John was a brutal tyrant, so bad that not only did the barons rise up against him, but the clergy rose up against him, the merchant class rose up against him, the poor rose up against him too. Not 100% sure, I heard that there was a trucker convoy in London around the time of King John. It was a bad time. Okay? And so it leads to a civil war in England in 1215. And the civil war is pretty violent. It doesn't look good for John, and he's forced to come to the negotiating table. And that's what he does. And at the negotiating table in June of 1215, King John is forced to sign the Magna Carta. Okay? The Magna Carta, which is a legal document where John finally agrees to bend his power to something more, something higher, that being the law. That he said, I am admitting by signing this that I am no longer an absolute ruler. So this is an incredible development at 1215 where the king admits that he's not an absolute tyrant. Now, a lot of legal history will tell you that this Magna Carta, it came about because a bunch of barons forced the king to sign it, and really was just about property and power and money. But that's not the full story. I mean, that's part of the story, but it's not the full story. In this painting, there's a man standing in the background looking over the signing of the Magna Carta. And that man is Stephen Langton. He was the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he was the Pope's representative, the Church's representative, the highest representative within England. And he's the one who mediates and negotiates between the barons and the king, and he's the one who drafts Magna Carta. And what you need to know about Richard Langdon is that he got his training, not just his theological training, but also legal training at a university in Paris, which taught him canon law. Canon law is the law of the church. And he takes all of the principles of canon law from the church, and he incorporates those principles, derived straight from scripture, he incorporates them into the Magna Carta. And there's still some sections of Magna Carta today that are still good law in the UK and in Canada. The very first, the opening paragraph of Magna Carta is not about liberty or equality or justice. The first opening paragraph is actually about the freedom of the church to be the church, to be free from the king's unjust interference in the affairs of faith. Okay, so this is because King John's father infamously had murdered the previous Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Becket. Okay, so King John you know, again, here we see the influence of a Christian worldview. We see the power of the Word of God influencing the development of canon law and now influencing the development of the Magna Carta, probably one of the greatest constitutional documents ever written in the history of the world. And it's got Christian DNA in it. Okay, so John signs it in June of 1215 and then regrets signing it about 2 months later. He goes to the Pope, asks the Pope in Rome, can you please annul this? Because, you know, I was under duress to sign this thing. And, oh, by the way, if you annul this agreement, I'll send you a bit more money. And so the Pope annuls it, and civil war breaks out again. And the only thing that saves the country of England from a very long, protracted civil war is that King John dies of excessive diarrhea. That's a true fact. It's also why we call toilets John's. I'm pretty sure that's a true fact. All right, we're going to have to fast forward again a little further. So we're going to go from 1215. So over the course of the 1200s, the Magna Carta keeps coming up again and again, right? King John dies, his son takes the throne. The barons say, okay, if you're going to be the king, you got to agree to Magna Carta too. And so the king is a young king. He says, okay, yeah, fine, I'll affirm Magna Carta. And this back and forth keeps going on and on throughout all of the 1200s. In fact, Magna Carta gets reissued or reaffirmed by the king 36 times in the course of 100 years. And then in 1297, so that's the end of the 1200s, it's actually passed into law as a statute. So no longer just a signed agreement between the king and his barons, but it becomes a passed statute by Parliament in 1297. So that's the official form of Magna Carta. Okay, so late 1200s, we've got now the development of Parliament. We've got this thing happening between the king and the barons and this Parliament, where whenever the king wants to get some money, he always have to ask Parliament for permission. Parliament always says, okay, we'll give you some more tax money if you just reaffirm Magna Carta. And this banter goes back and forth between the king and Parliament for a couple hundred years. Okay, then we get to this guy. Anyone know who this is? Yeah, King Henry. King Henry VIII, right? And he reasserts absolute power again, absolute ruler over both church and state. So the history of constitutionalism is not just one straight arc forward. It's an ebb and a flow. Sometimes it's two steps forward, one step back. And in Henry VIII, you've got that. You've got a two step forward, one step back kind of a person here. One thing that he does, he brings about the reformation of the church in England. There was a lot of corruption in the Roman Catholic Church at this time, and King Henry brings about the Reformation, not because he's a good, solid theologian, but because he really doesn't like his wife. He wants a divorce, and he wants to marry the good-looking girl serving in his court. And so he wants a divorce so he can get married to the younger, prettier girl in his court. So because of that evil arrangement by the king, the Lord works through that and around that and under that to bring about reformation in the church. And some of the key advisors to the king are reformed theologians, and they bring about a big reformation, which is really good. They're going back to scripture. Okay, so there's good and bad in there. One of the things he does that's quite bad is that he goes to the Roman Catholic Church and he seizes all of their property, or large amounts of their property, for himself. So one estimate is that the amount of money that King Henry takes for himself from all of the monasteries and so on, when he seizes their property, is the equivalent today to $2.2 billion worth of assets. It's a lot of money. That was just for himself. And then a bunch of his nobles and so on got a bunch of stuff too. Okay, so there's corruption there as well. Yeah, good development, but also really bad developments around the same time. And then what he does is King Henry says, and now I'm going to assert myself as a king over both the church and the state. So Rome, he tries to bend under the king. So the king is now the head of the church as well. And this is a problematic development. But we're going to keep on moving. King Henry has a bunch of kids. He has... So when he dies, his son Edward VI reigns for a short while. He's a Calvinist, so the kingdom becomes Calvinist. And then he dies, and his oldest sister Mary becomes the queen, and she's Roman Catholic, so the kingdom becomes Roman Catholic. And then she dies, and then her sister Elizabeth reigns, and she's an Anglican, so the kingdom becomes Anglican. And then she dies, and people are like, we're sick of this, because there's a lot of bloodshed every time that there's a change in religion. And they say, we need to have a nice, stable lineage that we need to have. And we have to have a sense of, as well, a sense of what is our cultural religion, what is our national religion. And so they end up going to the Stuarts in Scotland, and they go talk to King James VI of Scotland and say, can you become our king? And we're going to make sure that we just try to keep this lineage thing going without bloodshed every time we want to switch a king or a queen. And so King James VI of Scotland says, yes, I'll become your king. And he becomes King James I of England. And he comes down from Scotland, sits down on his throne in London, and all is going to be well. James I here, he's the guy that sponsors the King James Version of the Bible, okay? So it's the single most influential written text in the history of the world is the King James Bible. This guy paid for that. He sponsored that translation to make that happen. So some good things at the beginning of his reign. However, there's a problem with King James in that he has a particular idea, an idea or a theory, which is that of the divine right of kings, the divine right of kings. And the divine right of kings is the idea that there is Christ as king in heaven, and his representative on earth in all things is the king. The king is the Christ's representative over the church, the king is God's representative over the state, and the king is even the figurative head over the families of the nation as well. And so he cannot be questioned. His authority cannot be questioned because he is God's representative. So how dare you ever question his authority? The only person who can question King James I's authority is King James I. Now, there's other people around him that said, oh, wait a second, that's not great. This is another step backwards here. We need to push back on this. And one of the people that was willing to push back on King James I was Edward Coke, the inventor of Coca-Cola. And he's sitting there with a frilly thing around his... Oh, they both have frilly things around their neck. He's the one on the left with a frilly thing around his neck. And Lord Coke was a judge in England, one of the most famous judges in England. And he pushed back against the king. He was willing to say to the king, in the king's presence, he said, the king in his own person cannot judge any case that challenges the king's authority itself. Right? Up until then, the king was like, if you bring in a case against me, the king, I hear the case, and I will decide whether or not you're right or wrong. You're challenging the king. Like, that doesn't sound fair. And so that's what the judge says, Edward Coke. He says, no. If somebody's challenging something that the king has done, according to the standard of law, you need to have an impartial judge weigh in on that. And the king apparently was so offended by that statement, he nearly assaulted Coke in that room. He was so angry about that. And in the end, James punishes Lord Coke by transferring him to a lower court. There's another case that came up where Sir Francis Bacon, which some of you might know that name from science. He was a scientist. He developed the scientific method, for example. He was also a lawyer. And Sir Francis Bacon was the attorney general for the king. So he's a big defender of the king. And he was a defender of this idea of the divine right of kings. And Sir Francis Bacon said, he said, the king's title shall never be discussed. No man can contradict it. You can come with a claim against the king, but you must humbly supplicate to the king. So he's making this argument in court in front of Lord Coke and a bunch of other judges. And so Bacon says in his argument, he says to Lord Coke and a panel of nine judges, he says, therefore, I end my argument with this to you, the judges. He said, that obedience is better than sacrifice. I know that the court will remember whom they serve. He says this in a case involving a challenge to the authority of the king. And he says, obedience is better than sacrifice. Does anyone recognize where that phrase comes from? It's from Samuel. Samuel speaking to Saul, the king. Now, the funny thing is that Samuel was also not just a prophet. He was a judge, right? So there's some rich irony in the king's attorney general, the king's lawyer, saying to a judge, you need to obey And he's using the words of a judge to make the judge obey the king. It's a total reversal of what Samuel was intending to say. I'm not sure if the lawyer knew what he was doing there. He must have, though. He was a smart enough guy. So why was Lord Coke, this judge, standing his ground? Well, he was standing his ground because he was standing on a firm foundation. Lord Coke knew his Bible. He was a Christian through and through, and he knew his Bible. And one of the things that he knew in the Bible was Deuteronomy 16 and 17. Okay, so here's a selection from Deuteronomy 16, where God says to his people through Moses, he says, "Appoint judges and officials for each of your tribes in every town the Lord your God is giving you, and they shall judge the people fairly. Do not pervert justice or show partiality. Do not accept a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and twists the words of the innocent. Follow justice and justice alone, so that you may live and possess the land for the Lord your God is giving you." In other words, the standard is not, well, whatever the king thinks. The standard is justice, which is higher than the king. It's above the king. And the judge is bound to follow justice, not the whims of the king. Furthermore, Deuteronomy 17, again, God speaking through Moses says, "If cases come before your courts that are too difficult for you to judge, whether bloodshed, lawsuits, or assaults, take them to the place the Lord your God will choose. And go to the Levitical priests and to the judge who is in office at that time, inquire of them, and they will give you the verdict." Interesting here that if a judge is going to go to a priest, that means they're going to look to ecclesiastical leaders for additional wisdom in very, very difficult cases. I'm not sure the last time any of the pastors in this room have been called up by the local magistrate to say, "Hey, got this really tough case. Can you give me a hand? I just want to talk it through." That's what was happening in the Old Testament. Doesn't mean that we have to do that in the New Testament. Just saying that, look at the connection there between trying to judge cases fairly and rightly and uprightly. We need to be looking at a standard that's more than just the whims of a king or even the whims of a judge. There has to be a standard that's based in something firm, a firm foundation, which is here the law of God, of course. Continuing, he says, God says, "The king, moreover, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them, more horses. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again. He must not take many wives or his heart will be led astray. He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold." If you go to the story of King Solomon, you'll see that this is paralleled in King Solomon, and he makes this, he violates all three of these. That's an aside. But, and then when the king takes the throne of his kingdom, what does he have to do? He is to write for himself on a scroll a copy of this law taken from that of the Levitical priests. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and these decrees and not consider himself better than his fellow Israelites or turn from the law to the right or the left. In other words, the king has to be under the law. He has to know the law, and he has to be under the law. And that law is the law of God. If we depart from this, then things go downhill. And that's exactly what happens in the history of Israel. Okay, so that's why Lord Coke is standing the way he is. He says, the king can't judge his own cases. That's not fair. That's not right. It's not going to be just. You have to have judges doing it. And those judges need to be able to judge according to the standard of justice, not according to the pressure that the king is putting on them. Okay, well, so there's a lot of tension between Lord Coke and some other judges and the king, and there's tension between the king and parliament and so on. But eventually King James I dies, and his son Charles I becomes king. And this is where things get quite interesting. King Charles I has a problem, and that is he has a spending problem. You can tell by the clothes he's wearing, right? He loves lavish robes, and he loves to throw lavish parties, and he loves to give very expensive gifts to his friends and his suitors and so on. He has a massive spending problem. But you'll recall that I said that whenever the king wants more money, if he wants to raise taxes, he always has to get permission from Parliament to raise those taxes. And Parliament is pretty cautious about ever saying no, and they almost always say yes. But eventually Parliament got so sick of this guy spending so much money that they eventually said, no, we're not giving you a raise. We're not allowing to raise taxes at all. So King Charles is a little ticked about that. And so he says, well, there's got to be, he's a clever guy. He was a conniving king. And so he said, well, I can figure out a different way to raise money. I have what's called the royal prerogative. And the royal prerogative gives me the right to issue an executive order of sorts. And so what he does is he says, okay, I can't raise taxes. Parliament has to do that for me, and they won't do it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to issue a loan. I'm going to call in a loan. It's a voluntary loan. A loan is not a tax. But everybody has to pay me the loan, and you know, we'll see whether or not I pay it back. And it applies to everybody who's gentry and up, okay? So Five Knights, there's a court case called the Five Knights case. So Five Knights said, well, wait a second, that's not a loan, that's a tax. But you're calling it a loan, but it's a tax. If I have no choice but to pay it, to loan it to you, and there's no promise on the return of the loan, that's a tax. So we're not going to give it to you because you're not allowed to tax us. And so King Charles throws him in jail. And so the Five Knights are languishing in jail, and they say, okay, we're going to go to court and try to get a judge to hear our case to get us out. And that's what they do. They go to court, and we have the Five Knights case. And the court ends up ruling 5-4 in favor of the king. They say, well, you know, it may or may not be a loan or a tax or whatever, but, you know, this case is about whether or not these Five Knights are in jail for a good reason. And, well, if the king put them in jail, then they must be in jail for a good reason. Therefore, their imprisonment is justified. Now, that caused a bit of a furor within Parliament because these Five Knights also sat in Parliament. And so Parliament put all kinds of pressure on the king, and he relented, and he ended up releasing them, and he ended up dropping the forced loan. But he still had his spending problem, and so he connived another way to raise money, and that's with the ship money case. So in the ship money case, the king said, okay, wait a second, I've got this royal prerogative, this ability to impose particular fees from time to time in particular needs. And this is where the emergency power thing comes in, okay? So he said, I have the power to impose what's called a ship money tax. A ship money tax was something that the king could impose in times of emergency, in particular in times of war, which he would impose on the coastal communities in order to fund the navy, right? So if England's at war, they're at war with the navy because they're an island and everybody else is on the mainland, France and Spain and so on. And so the navy is their most important asset, right? And the ones who are most vulnerable are the communities that live on the coast. And so it makes sense that if we're going to defend the nation, we want to make sure that those coastal communities can put up a bit of extra money to pay for the navy, build ships, and then defend the country. So he says, I have the royal prerogative to do that, and therefore I'm going to impose the ship money tax on every person in the whole nation, whether they're on the coast or not, and I get to determine whether or not there actually is an emergency, how long the emergency is, and what I do with the money once I collect it for that emergency. And so one person challenged that and said, no, that can't be right. That can't be right. There actually has to be an emergency. And the king said, well, you know, there's always a threat of war with France, and so that's an emergency, and so I'm going to impose this tax. And it went to court. And again, one of the lawyers arguing for the king, he said that, well, if somebody says the king can only raise money through Parliament, well, that would be yoking the king, and that would mean that that would be a bad policy. We can't yoke the king like that. He needs to be free to do what he wants. And the lawyer for the king said he had never heard that lex was rex, that is, that the law was king. But instead, he said it's the reverse. He said the king is the law, the lex loquens, which is a living, speaking, acting law. The king is the law itself. Well, in the end, in this case too, a majority of the judges ruled in the king's favor, because if they didn't, they risked their jobs because they served as judges at the pleasure of the king. And so a majority, again, it was a slim majority, I think it was a 5-4 split, but a majority of the judges sided with the king, and they said, yeah, the ship money tax on everybody, and the personal opinion of the king on the nature of an emergency existing or not, that will leave to the prerogative of the king. And Parliament did not like that at all, and war broke out. And so we get the English Civil War, 1642 to 1651. It's the single bloodiest conflict in the history of England. On a per capita basis, more Englishmen died in this English Civil War than in any other battle or war ever, including World War I or World War II. Okay? Very bloody war. And of course, with wars, you don't only lose your working force men in battle. That leads usually to famine and poverty, right? Because nobody can harvest the fields anymore and so on. It eventually ends with the execution of King Charles I. So the forces of Parliament are fighting against the royal forces. Eventually, parliamentary forces win under Lord Cromwell, and the king is put on trial for, what's the word I'm looking for? I should have written it down. He's put on trial for, what is it? Treason. Treason, that's the word I'm looking for. Put on trial for treason because throughout the war, he kept on he kept the war going. He had many opportunities to end the war, and he didn't. He kept the war going. It cost thousands and thousands of lives. And so they put him on trial for treason. They found him guilty, and he was executed on January 30th, 1649. Okay, out of that conflict, we get two different publications which are key for us to understand. The first publication comes from a pastor, a Presbyterian or a Puritan pastor, Samuel Rutherford, writing up in Scotland. And he writes a book called Lex Rex. If you haven't read it, I recommend you try to read it. It's a bit tough. It's a bit older English, of course, and it's a bit dense, but it's a good book. And in it, he basically looks back to those passages from Deuteronomy and other passages in Scripture to show that it's the law which is king, not the king who is the law. And he bases that argument on Scripture as his foundation. And so he argues for the idea that power has to be contained. There has to be checks and balances on human power. That's one argument coming out of the English Civil War from Samuel Rutherford. And it seems to me that he picked the title in response to that court case where the lawyer for the king was saying, "Well, I've never heard of Lex Rex." Instead, it's the king is the law himself. So he's responding to that. He says, no, the king has to be under the law. But at the same time, another book comes out called Leviathan by the philosopher Thomas Hobbes. And philosopher Thomas Hobbes was the tutor to King Charles I's son, King Charles II. And he argued, he looked at all the blood and the terror of war, and he said, the only way to avoid this is to vest all power, both ecclesiastical power and civil power, into a single person, Leviathan, the king. And that's the image from the original book. And you can see that's the king, King Charles I there, holding both the sword of state and the scepter representing church power. He said, that's the only way we can avoid it. We've suffered through war and now famine and plague and everything else because we can't get along. We just have to vest all of our power into a single person. He's sort of right in the sense that all power is vested into a single person. His name is Jesus Christ. And he separates that power out among different spheres. Christ, in his divine design for society, is he gives some power to the church, some power to the state, some power to the institution of the family, and so on. And Leviathan and Thomas Hobbes misses that point. He thinks all power has to be vested in a single earthly authority, and there he's dead wrong. History keeps on marching forward. I have one more episode in our history that's very important for us. The Civil War results in a period of republic, of the English Republic under Lord Cromwell. It doesn't fare so well. It lasts about 12 years, and then it collapses. And Parliament ends up saying, we need a king again. And so they go back to King Charles II, who's the son of King Charles I. They say, come on back, be our king. And he agrees to do that, but he keeps on ruling like an absolute monarch. He persecutes the faithful church, so Baptists and Presbyterians and Puritans are persecuted under King Charles II pretty viciously, particularly in Scotland. England puts up with him for about 25 years. He dies and his brother takes over, James II. James II is even more vicious, and he reigns for about 3 years. He starts playing monkey tricks with Parliament, and Parliament's like, nope, we're not doing this again, and they stage the Glorious Revolution of 1688. And the Glorious Revolution of 1688 is glorious because the English had to ask the Dutch, which are my ancestors, to rule over them because they hadn't really been able to figure it out themselves. And that's why it's called the Glorious Revolution. That's a joke. Any Dutch people in the... Hey. Oh, yes. Good. Yes. All right. So this is what happened. Parliament did not like James II. He was acting like a tyrant. He was ruling like a tyrant. He had disbanded Parliament. He was basically ruling through executive order. And Parliament's, we can't do this again. We've just suffered through a civil war. We're not gonna go down this path again. So in 1688, they go to William III in the Netherlands. He's a prince there, William of Orange, and they say to him, can you come and be our king? And if you do, we'll be your subjects, but you can only be a king on the condition that you sign the Bill of Rights. And so the king said, yep, okay, I will do that. And he was going to be king, co-regent with his wife, Mary. Mary is the daughter of James II. And so they agreed to do that. And so William and Mary sail over to England in late 1688, and they march on London. Okay, so this is the real reason it's called the Glorious Revolution, is because it's a bloodless revolution. As William is marching on London, King James II flees, and he abdicates, is what Parliament said. He abdicates, he flees to France. And so the revolution takes place without any blood shed. That's a glorious revolution. But it's it's a glorious revolution for another reason, and that is because it gives us responsible government. Now, when people hear the word responsible government, they think it means, oh, it's a government that's very responsible. You know, they don't spend beyond their means. They always balance the budget, that sort of thing. That's not what we mean by responsible government. But really what we mean by responsible government is that the government, which is the executive branch, which is headed by the king, but it's all of the bureaucracy that governs day to day, they are responsible to Parliament. That's what we mean by responsible government. And if you come back for part two, you'll see why this is really, really important and why this is being undermined. So for the first time, we have the king not only having to ask Parliament for permission to raise taxes, but now we have the king answering to Parliament for how he conducts himself day to day. Parliament becomes the ones who safeguard the rights and the liberties of the people that they represent. Okay? And so that's the second reason. And the third reason it's called the Glorious Revolution is because it gives us the Bill of Rights. It's the after Magna Carta, it's the next most important constitutional document that guarantees the rights of Englishmen across the country, and the king submits to it. He signs that into law and he submits to it. Part of the Glorious Revolution, it doesn't get enacted until about 20 years later. No, that's not true. 10, 11, 12, 13 years later, is the Act of Settlement. You'll remember that King James I and King Charles I kept firing judges that disagreed with him or demoting them or threatening to do that. And so these judges kept ruling in favor of the king. Well, the Act of Settlement 1701 fixes that problem. What Parliament does is we're going to pass a law that makes judges independent from the king. So the king can appoint a judge, but then once they're appointed, they get a secure salary and they can't be fired by the king. And that way, judges become blind when they're weighing cases against the king. And so by the end of the Glorious Revolution, we have this separation of powers. The judiciary has the power to make judgments on the law, the executive government has the power to put law into action, and Parliament has the power to make and change the law after careful deliberation and to hold the executive to account. So we have responsible government, we have the separation of powers, and we come back to this phrase from Lord Acton, which is that power tends to corrupt, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And what we have is a cultural change in England, particularly the Reformation in the 1500s and the rise of Puritanism in the 1600s, that leads to this total reorganization of government, giving us responsible government, separation of powers, and a contained and tyranny contained. So if you're interested, you can come back to part two where I take all of that history and apply it to our Canadian setting. I am done. Thank you very much.